Greetings and Strombolian magnifications, my corpusculently radiant listeners, and welcome to this March 2018 Science News Update. I'm your host for this dotard, a pouring science podcast segment, Jim Campanella. So, okay, I've tried really hard, and I could not find this month any idiot scientist that deserves an award. I think this is probably a good thing, whether it decreases my entertainment value or not. But I'm sure there'll be somebody next month who's an idiot. Anyway, let's talk science. First story of the night. If you were an alien living on a planet in Proxima Centauri about a year ago, then you are quite literally toast at this point. Proxima Centauri is Earth's nearest planet-hosting neighbor, and it released a gigantic flare last year at this time, if you missed the news, and that would have been bad news for any potential life on that star's planet, Proxima B. The star got about 1,000 times brighter over 10 seconds before dimming again. That can best be explained by an enormous stellar flare, says astronomer Dr. Meredith McGregor of the Carnegie Institution for Science. This was written up in the February 26 issue of Astrophysical Journal Letters. Because Proxima B is so much closer to its star than Earth is to the Sun, the star would have blasted Proxima B with about 4,000 times more radiation than Earth typically gets from any of Sol's flares. McGregor says, quote, "If flares like this are at all frequent from Proxima Centauri, then any exoplanet that is too nearby is likely not to be in the best shape," unquote. I've chatted about Proxima B in the past on Science Updates because it is one of the most sought-after sites for finding life outside the solar system. It's just 4 light years away, and it has a mass of about the same as the Earth, and probably has temperatures suitable enough for liquid water. But its star is an M-class dwarf. That's a class of small, dim star, which is notoriously prone to flares that could rip away a planet's atmosphere. McGregor and her colleagues reanalyzed data from a recent study led by astronomer Dr. Guillaume Anglada of the Institute of Astrophysics of Andalusia. Anglada had observed Proxima Centauri and saw extra light that he interpreted as a ring of dust, quote-unquote. However, Anglada had averaged the amount of light over a full 10 hours of observations, and that would have smeared out any short-term changes in the star's brightness, like a huge flare. When McGregor's team reanalyzed the data, they found that all the excess light came from the same 2-minute period on March 24th. McGregor says a massive flare explains all that extra light, and none of it was masquerading as a quote-unquote glittering dust ring. For the next story, why don't we stay in space and get an update of the famous Drake equation. Dr. Claudio Grimaldi and colleagues from Federal Polytechnical School of Lausanne in Switzerland published their updated calculation of the Drake equation recently in the online journal Archive. And they have concluded that if signals from an alien civilization ever reach Earth, odds are that the aliens will already be dead by the time we hear it. Great, how cheery that is. So much for half the glass being full. I guess in this case there's no glass at all. So, in an effort to update the 1961 Drake equation, which estimates the number of detectable intelligent civilizations in the Milky Way, Grimaldi calculated the area of the galaxy that should be filled with alien signals at any given time. That actually sounds more promising than it turned out to be. In fact, Grimaldi's team actually included Dr. Frank Drake, who now is a professor emeritus at the SETI Institute in California, and also the University of California. So Grimaldi was probably about as accurate as he's going to be here. The new calculation assumes technologically savvy civilizations born and die at a constant rate. It also assumes that when a civilization dies out and stops broadcasting, The signals it had sent continued traveling like concentric ripples in a pond. And part of the Milky Way should be filled with these ghost signals. Grimaldi reports that if a civilization lasts less than 100,000 years, the time it takes light to cross the galaxy, then the odds of the signals reaching the Earth while the civilization is still broadcasting are pretty small. Humans, for example, have been transmitting radio waves for only about 80 years, so our radio waves now cover less than 1/1,000th of the percent of the Milky Way. Grimaldi says, quote, if the civilization emitted from the other side of the galaxy, when the signal arrives here, the civilization will already be gone by our calculations, unquote. Surprisingly, the team also calculated the average number of ET signals crossing Earth at any given time should equal the number of civilizations currently transmitting, even if the civilizations we hear from aren't the same ones presently broadcasting. Grimaldi is now working on a paper about what it means that we've heard absolutely nothing so far. So, what do I think it means? Well, my first thought is they simply are not out there. Maybe it's like the lyrics of the Red Dwarf theme song. We're all alone, more or less. Hey, humans have been told over and over again since the European Renaissance that we are not so special, and the universe does not revolve around us. And Darwin and Freud made it abundantly clear that we could be knocked even further off our high horse as humans. But what if they're wrong? What if life really is unique here on Earth? Or what if intelligent life is even more rare than the Drake equation suggests? I know the Drake equation says otherwise, and that there should be a ton of life out there, but hey, where is it? Maybe it's not there. Or perhaps the aliens are purposely ignoring us and keeping hidden, as suggested by more than a few SF authors? Frankly, if they're keeping hidden, I really can't blame them, given half of what I see of the human race. And perhaps Grimaldi's next paper will clarify life, the universe, and everything. But I seriously doubt it. Next story is a topic near and dear to my heart. Sleep. By the way, a brief update on my sleep apnea, since I still get emails about this, even though I last mentioned it about a year ago. I have ameliorated much of the issues with sleep apnea by getting a special pillow that keeps me sleeping at an angle of about 40 degrees. And that angle puts less pressure on my soft palate, and I guess, according to my wife, I seem to be sleeping without gasping for air every few minutes, like a beached fish gasping for water. Yippee-ki-yay. So anyway, getting back to science, this new story was published on Valentine's Day in the American Journal of Anthropology by Dr. Charles Nunn of Duke University. It turns out that humans sleep less per day than any other primate. A large comparison of primate sleep patterns finds that most primate species get anywhere between 9 and 15 hours of shut-eye daily, while humans average just about 7. An analysis of several lifestyle and biological factors predicts that humans should be getting about 9.5 hours of sleep. And even though we don't sleep enough, most of the primates in the study typically sleep as much as the paper's statistical models predict they should. The paper says that two long-standing features of human life have contributed to unusually short sleep times. First, when humans descended from the trees to sleep on the ground, individuals probably had to spend more time awake to guard against predator attacks than they did when they were safely up in the trees. Second, humans have faced intense pressure to learn and teach new skills and to make social connections at the expense of sleep. As sleep declined, rapid eye movement, REM sleep, as you all know, which is linked to learning and memory, came to play an outsized role in human slumber. And non-REM sleep accounts for an unexpectedly small share of human sleep now, even though it may also aid memory. Nunn says, quote, it's pretty surprising that non-REM sleep time is so low in humans, but something had to give as we slept less. Our primate relatives have much more non-REM sleep than we do on average, unquote. None used two statistical models to calculate expected daily amounts of sleep for each of the species. For 20 of those species, enough data existed to estimate expected amounts of REM and non-REM sleep. And estimates of all sleep times relied on databases of previous primate sleep findings, largely involving captive animals wearing electrodes that measure brain activity during slumber. To generate predicted sleep values for each primate, the researchers consulted earlier studies of links between sleep patterns and various aspects of primate biology, behavior, and environments. So based on these factors, the researchers predicted humans should sleep an average of 9.5 hours every day. And again, humans sleep an average of about 7, and even less in some groups. The 36% shortfall between the predicted and the actual sleep is far greater than any other primate in the study. Nunn estimates that people now spend an average of 1.56 hours of sleep time in REM, about as much as the models predict should be spent in that sleep phase. An apparent rise in the proportion of human sleep devoted to REM apparently resulted mainly from a hefty decline in that non-REM sleep that I mentioned earlier. And by their calculations, people should spend an average of 8.42 hours in non-REM sleep daily, whereas the actual figure is only about 5.5 hours. So why is this lack of sleep such a worry? Well, it may be one reason, as some people have suggested, that Alzheimer's and similar neurodegenerative diseases have started to occur as we age. If you remember, I explained last month about the specialized lymph system that cleans the brain as we sleep. I explained at that time that the glymph system, as it's called, can become more efficient with a bit of alcohol every day. Well, to put it simply, if we don't sleep enough, our brains do not get the full cleansing benefits of the glymph system. This may be one explanation why neurofibrillary tangles arise more often in Homo sapiens than any other primate. This hypothesis may also explain why those with sleep apnea are more prone to neurodegenerative diseases than the general population. They're getting even less sleep than the average human. This is quite eye-opening and quite depressing at the same time. Next story. A world's record. So how deep do you think that you can find water in the Earth's crust? I would bet that your guess is wrong, unless you're a geologist who specializes in stuff like that. I mean, my guess was off by magnitudes. But, quote, deep within the hot interior of the earth, ice lurks, unquote. That's from the paper. My immediate response when I read that was, come on, that's nonsense. Everything I know about geology says that the farther down you go, the hotter it gets, right? So what's this nonsense about ice deep in the earth? Well, it turns out that I'm pretty darned ignorant when it comes to such things. Yeah, there's ice down there. A form of supercompact ice has been found embedded inside diamonds, and it offers the first direct clue that there is abundant water more than 600 kilometers in the mantle. Yes, 600 kilometers. That's about 380 miles for all of you Americans out there. Dr. Oliver Schauner of the University of Nevada and his colleagues reported this on March 8th in the journal Science. This ice, identified by its crystal structure, called Ice 7, doesn't exist at Earth's surface. It only forms at pressures greater than 24 billion pascals, corresponding to depths of about 610 to 800 kilometers. Its presence in diamonds suggests that there is water-rich fluid in the transition zone between the upper and lower mantle, and even into the top of the lower mantle. Just as a side note before I go on, I kind of freaked out when I first read this because my ability to read Roman numerals has always kind of stank. And I thought the paper was about Ice 9. For those of you not familiar with Ice 9, it's a fictional material that appears in Kurt Vonnegut's novel Cat's Cradle. Ice 9 is described as a polymorph of water, which, instead of melting at 0 degrees Celsius, melts at 45 degrees Celsius. And when ice 9 comes into contact with liquid water below 45 degrees Celsius, it acts as kind of a seed crystal and causes the solidification of the entire body of water. And then that quickly crystallizes into more ice 9. As people are mostly water, ice 9 kills nearly instantly when ingested or brought into contact with soft tissue and close to the bloodstream. You can see why I kind of freaked out when I misread the story. Anyway, the story is about Ice 7, not the nasty homicidal ice. So, how did water get down hundreds of kilometers? Well, when slabs of the Earth's crust sink into the mantle below, they drag ocean water with them. How deep the slabs actually sink has been a long-standing question. Researchers have suspected that abundant aqueous fluid exists in the deep mantle, moved down there by slabs bearing water-rich minerals that shed their water when they reach the transition zone. But scientists have not previously found direct evidence of that water being there. That's where the diamonds come in. Diamonds form at high temperatures and pressures, crystallizing in pockets rich in the mineral carbonate before being carried to the surface with erupting magma. I learned that when I was a kid from a Superman comic where the Man of Steel made a diamond from the graphite from his mechanical pencil. He super squeezed and blew superheated air into his hand to do it. Anyway, as the diamond crystals form, they can enclose tiny amounts of fluid or rock from their surroundings. And these impurities represent tiny capsules of mantle. Diamond inclusions are the only direct window that the scientists have into the fabric of Earth more than a kilometer beneath the surface. Schauner wasn't looking for ice in his study. He was hunting for signs of a molecular form of carbon dioxide that could reveal clues to the cycling of carbon from the slabs into the mantle. He used an array of techniques to study all this to identify the inclusions within the diamonds. One of the diamonds was from China and two from South Africa. And instead of carbon dioxide, his group sought the telltale patterns of water in the X-ray scattering that passed through the diamond. And that pattern pointed to Ice 7. The presence of that extremely high-pressure form of ice was a powerful clue to the depth at which the diamond must have formed. Schauner explains in this very long quote why water deep in the earth is so important. Quote, water-rich fluids deep in the mantle could be important for driving the circulation that fuels the movements of tectonic plates and eruptions of volcanoes. The presence of water can make it easier for rocks to melt by lowering the melting point of hot rock under pressure, and fluids can help redistribute heat within the mantle. What's more, some large heat-producing radioactive elements like potassium, thorium, and uranium don't easily fit into the rigid crystalline structure of minerals and prefer melted rock. You just need a little bit of fluid and they move into the melt, unquote. Next story. Is it possible to reconstruct somebody's face based on their genetics? Well, Dr. Seth Weinberg of the University of Pittsburgh and colleagues say maybe. His group has identified 15 genes that determine our facial features. And if they're right about these genes and their effects, just imagine. Doctors could use DNA for skull and facial reconstructive surgery. Forensic examiners could sketch a perpetrator's face on the basis of DNA retrieved from a crime scene. Historians would be able to reconstruct facial features using DNA from the past. Guess we're looking at you, Bilbo Baggins. Anyway, the study entitled Genome-Wide Mapping of Global to Local Genetic Effects on Human Facial Shape appeared this month in the journal Nature Genetics. Weinberg states, quote, genome-wide association scans of complex multipartite traits like the human face typically use pre-selected phenotypic measures. Here, we report a data-driven approach to phenotyping facial features at multiple levels of organization, allowing for an open-ended description of facial variation while preserving statistical power. In a sample of 2,329 people of European ancestry, we identified 38 loci, 15 of which replicated in an independent European sample of 1,719 people. Unquote. Well, it seems that all the replicated loci, the genes, highlighted distinctive patterns of global to local genetic effects on facial shape, and they apparently were enriched for active chromatin elements in the human cranial neural crest cells, suggesting an early developmental origin of the facial variation. These results have implications for studies of facial genetics and other complex morphological traits. Weinberg further states, quote, "We're basically looking for needles in a haystack. In the past, we would select specific features, including the distance between the eyes or the width of the mouth. We would then look for a connection between this feature and other genes. This has already led to the identification of a number of genes, but of course the results are limited because only a small set of features are selected and tested." Unquote. In the current study, each phase was automatically subdivided into smaller modules. Next, they examined whether any locations in the DNA matched those modules. This modular division technique, as he calls it, made it possible for the first time to check for an unprecedented number of facial features. The scientists were able to identify 15 locations in the DNA, as I said, and the Stanford team found out that genomic loci linked to these modular facial features are active when our face develops in utero. 7 of the 15 of those genes are linked to the nose, and it should become much easier in the future to determine the shape of the nose of some unknown person than previously. And this has always been a problem in the past, because especially if you've just got a skull, how do you determine what the shape of the nose is? You can't. It's very, very difficult, because the nose is made of tissue and doesn't stick around like the skull does. Next story. Can simply standing instead of sitting help you lose weight? Well, yeah, apparently it can. And you don't even have to exercise. In a study last month, published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, Dr. Claes Olsson from the University of Gothenburg and colleagues said that standing, at least in mice, activates what the authors call an internal bathroom scale, quote-unquote. By this they mean that there is some sort of mechanism in your body that detects changes in weight and then regulates your weight by sending signals to the brain to either eat more or eat less. Yes, all that weight pushing down onto your feet is detected and acted upon by your body. I find this absolutely amazing. The last time an entirely new body fat regulatory process was identified was way back in 1994, and that was with the discovery of leptin. You may remember that leptin is a hormone secreted by fat cells, and increasing the number of fat cells causes an increase in the amount of leptin, which then travels to the hypothalamus to signal the brain to eat less. Despite its involvement in body weight regulation and the years of research, the discovery of leptin hasn't really led to any new obesity treatments. Olsson says, quote, "Very often, several different mechanisms work together to regulate a physiological process, and it seems as if leptin by itself cannot cure human obesity," unquote. Yeah. Thank you, Claes. No kidding. It seems that Olsson wanted to determine what additional mechanisms besides leptin regulate fat mass and body weight. And to research this, he turned to mice and rats with diet-induced obesity. He implanted capsules weighing 15% of the animal's body weight into their abdomens and empty capsules into control animals. And surprisingly, the body fat of the animals walking around carrying the weighted capsules decreased by the exact same amount as the capsules that were added. He and his group were surprised that the weight loss had nothing to do with leptin. Further experiments show that the mechanism is regulated by a unique load-sensing cell type, the osteocytes, located in foot bones. Previous research suggested that osteocytes regulate bone mass by sensing short-term high-impact changes in body weight. And Olson hypothesized that sustained, slightly increased loading also might exert its effect on body weight by the osteocytes. And the team repeated the experiments, and this time they added weight capsules to mice without osteocytes. And these mice didn't change their eating patterns to account for the extra weight, confirming a role for osteocytes in body weight regulation. Osteocytes may not be the only players in the body's weight-sensing capabilities. Olson and colleagues believe there's also a biological sensor that depends on the osteocytes, and they're presently hunting for that sensor and hope to soon identify it. Olson cautioned that there are other factors to consider before we all start standing to lose weight. For example, body weight fluctuates depending upon the existence of homeostatic body weight regulation. Olson says, quote, homeostatic mechanisms try to keep the phenotype constant, but like for most diseases, the different homeostatic mechanisms are not perfect in all subjects as a result of environmental or genetic differences. We don't even know yet whether this homeostatic system even exists in humans. We hope so, but we don't know yet. Unquote. All right. Well, this last story of the night should be giving Smokey the Bear sleepless nights, because it is quite nightmarish. In fact, Alfred Hitchcock would have loved this one. It has now been confirmed that birds of prey in Australia are not only responsible for the spread of wildfires, but they're doing it deliberately. This means that humans are not unique in having harnessed fire and were perhaps even beaten out by these avian arsonists. This is not the first time that evidence that raptors might have been harnessing the red flower for their own use. Back in 2016, ornithologist Bob Gottsford reported multiple accounts that both black kites and brown falcons were spreading wildfires in northern Australia, something that slotted in with indigenous Aboriginal knowledge about the birds. But many other experts were skeptical about the behavior. It seemed obvious that the birds were spreading fires. However, lots of scientists simply didn't believe that there was any intent behind it, and that it was nothing more than accidental on the raptors' behalf. In response to this criticism, Gosford spent last year collecting even more eyewitness accounts of birds of prey deliberately carrying burning sticks and embers to set alight other bits of grassland. In his latest paper, which was published in the Journal of Ethnobiology last month, Gosford details another 20 eyewitness reports of this behavior, as well as adding the whistling kite to the select group of fire-starting birds. It's thought that the birds are taking advantage of lightning strikes that spark wildfires in northern Australia. This is a natural process that frequently occurs, and the plants and landscape are well adapted to the blazes that ravage the area, just like, California. The raptors have been observed picking up burning twigs from these blazes and then flying up to 50 meters away to unburnt patches of grassland and forest, where they deliberately drop them, spreading the fire. Following this, the birds will then sit at the advancing edge of the fire and wait for small mammals and reptiles and amphibians and insects to flee the flames, picking off the hapless critters as they make a run for it. This latest paper has collated a whole raft of accounts. One such report comes from a former firefighter, Dick Ewson, who was fighting a fire near Kakadu in the Northern Territory. He recounts how, quote, we were tackling one, then realized another and spread at the other side of the road. We found a whistling kite sitting in a tree holding a smoking stick. During the call out, we had to extinguish a total of 7 new fires. All of them were started by birds. All right. Forgive me for the terrible Australian accent. Oh, that was awful. Anyway, the behavior could explain why fires just suddenly appear to jump fire breaks. And the researchers are now asking for similar reports from other parts of the world, like Africa and the Americas, to further our understanding of both humanity's relationship with fire and the historic spread of savannas. Wow, I see a sequel at this point to Hitchcock's thriller, The Birds. We can call it Angry Birds with Fire. Or maybe not. All right. That's all from me for now. As always, take care. Stand up if you're sitting at your computer. Keep away from Ice Nine. Keep watching the skies for birds brandishing burning sticks. And I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.